The fleet reached the head of the first cataract above Elephantine, and we moored against the bank in the quiet flow of the river before the Nile felt the urging of the cascades and plunged into the gorge. We waited for the rest of the army to be ferried down to us, all the horses and the chariots and Lord Krutas' pagan Shilluk regiments. We also waited for the Nile to rise and open the cataract for us to pass down into Egypt. While we waited, we sent spies down through the gorge. They were dressed as peasants and priests and merchants with goods to trade. I went down with Krutas into the gorge to map and mark the passage. Now at low water, every hazard was exposed. We painted channel markers on the rocks above the high water line so that even when the flood covered them, we would still know where their obstacles lurked. We were many weeks at this labour, and when we returned to where the fleet was moored, the army was assembled there. We sent out scouting parties to find a route for the chariots and the horses through the rock desert down into Egypt. We could not risk such a precious cargo to the wild waters of the cataract. Our spies began to return from Elephantine. They came in secretly and singly, usually in the night. They brought us the very first news of our motherland that we had heard in all the years of exile. King Salatus still reigned, but he was old now, and his beard had turned silver-white. His two sons were the mighty men of the Hyksos legions. Prince Bion commanded the infantry, and Prince Apachan commanded the chariots. The might of the Hyksos exceeded all our estimates. Our spies reported that Apachan disposed of 12,000 chariots. We had brought down only 4,000 from Kush. Bion had 40,000 archers and infantry. Even with Krutas Shilluk, we could muster only 15,000. We were heavily outnumbered. There was cheering news also. The great bulk of the Hyksos force was held in the delta, and Salatus had made his capital at the city of Memphis. It would take months for him to move his forces south to Elephantine and Thebes. He would not be able to bring his chariots upriver until the floods abated and the land dried. There was only a single squadron of chariots guarding the city of Elephantine, 100 chariots to oppose our entry. They were of the old solid wheel type. It seemed that the Hyksos had not yet perfected the spoked wheel. Prince Memnon laid out his battle plan for us. We would pass through the cataract on the flood and seize Elephantine. Then, while Salatus moved southwards to oppose us, we would march on Thebes, raising the populace in insurrection as we went. We could expect Salatus to give battle with his full army on the floodplains before Thebes, once the Nile waters had subsided. By then we could hope that the disparity in the numbers of the two armies would be redressed in part by the Egyptian troops that would rally to our standard. We learned from our spies that the Hyksos did not suspect the presence of our army of liberation so close to their border, and that we could expect to gain the element of surprise with our first assault. We learned also that Salatus had adopted our Egyptian way of life. These days he lived in our palaces and worshipped our gods. Even his old Sutekh had changed his name to Seth, and was very appropriately still his principal god. Although all his senior officers were Hyksos, many of Salatus' captains and sergeants had been recruited from amongst the Egyptians, and half the common soldiers were of our own nation. Most of these would have been infants or not yet born at the time of our exodus. We wondered where their loyalties would lie when Prince Memnon led our army down into Egypt. All was in readiness now. The scouts had marked a road through the desert of the West Bank, and the water wagons had laid down stores of fodder and water jars along the length of it, enough to see our chariots through to the fertile plains of our very Egypt. Our galleys were rigged and manned for battle. When the Nile flooded, we would sail, but in the meantime there was one last ritual to complete. We climbed the bluff above the river to where the obelisk that my mistress had raised over 2 decades before still stood, a tall and elegant finger of stone pointing into the cloudless blue of the African sky. My mistress was too weak to climb the rugged pathway to the summit. 10 slaves carried her up in a sedan chair and set her down below the tall monument. She walked painfully slowly to the foot of the pillar on the arm of Prince Memnon and gazed up at the inscription carved in the granite. Our whole nation watched her. All those souls who had found their way back to this point from which we had set out so long ago. My mistress read the inscription aloud. Her voice was soft, but still so musical that it carried clearly to where I stood behind the great lords and the generals. I, Queen Lostris, regent of Egypt and widow of Pharaoh Mamoza, the eighth of that name, mother of the crown prince Memnon, who shall rule the two kingdoms after me, have ordained the raising of this monument." When she had finished the reading, she turned to face her people and spread her arms. "I have done that which was required of me," she said, and her voice regained some of its old power. "I have led you back to the border of your land. My task is completed, and I relinquish the regency." She paused, and for a moment her eyes met mine over the heads of the nobles. I nodded slightly to encourage her, and she went on. "Citizens of Egypt, it is fitting that you have a true pharaoh to lead you the last steps of the way home. I give you the divine pharaoh Tamoza, who once was the crown prince Memnon. May he live forever." "May he live forever," the nation roared in one voice. "May he live forever." Pharaoh Tamoza stepped forward to face his people. "May he live forever," they shouted the third time. And our new pharaoh drew the blue sword from its jeweled scabbard and saluted them with it. In the silence that followed, his voice rang and echoed from the gaunt red crags of the hills. "I take up the sacred trust. I swear on my hope of eternal life to serve my people and my land all my days. I shall not flinch from this duty, and I call upon all the gods to witness my oath." The flood came. The waters rose up the rocks that guarded the entrance to the gorge, and the colour changed from green to grey. The cataract began to growl like a beast in its lair, and the spray cloud rose into the sky and stood as high as the hills that flanked the Nile. I went aboard the leading galley with Lord Kratas and Pharaoh. We dropped our mooring and shoved off into the stream. The rowers on the benches were stripped to their breech clouts. Their faces turned up to watch Kratas as he stood high in the stern, gripping the steering oar in his bear-like fists. In the bows, two teams of sailors under the king stood ready with heavy oars to fend off. I stood beside Kratas, with the map of the rapids spread on the deck in front of me, ready to call the twists and turns of the channel to him as we came to them. I did not really need the map, for I had memorized every line drawn upon it, in addition to which I had stationed reliable men on the sides of the gorge and on the islands in the main stream ahead of us. They would use signal flags to show us the way through. As the current quickened beneath our keel, I cast one last glance backwards and saw the rest of the squadron fall into line astern behind us, ready to follow us down the cataract. Then I looked forward again and felt the fist of fear tighten on my bowels so that I was forced to squeeze my buttocks together. Ahead of us, the gorge smoked like the mouth of a furnace. Our speed built up with deceptive stealth. The rowers touched the surface lightly with the blades of the oars, just enough to keep our bows pointed downstream. We floated so lightly and so smoothly that we seemed to be drifting. It was only when I looked at the banks and saw them streaming past us that I realized how fast we were running. The rock portals of the gorge flew to meet us. Nonetheless, it was only when I noticed the grin on Kratas' craggy face that I realized the true danger of what we were attempting. Kratas only grinned like that when he saw Death crook a bony finger at him. "Come on, you rogues!" he shouted at his crew. "This day I'll make your mothers proud of you, or I'll find work for the Embabas." The river was split by three islands, and the channel narrowed. "Bear to port and steer for the Blue Cross." I tried to sound casual, but at that moment I felt the deck tip beneath my feet and I clutched at the rail. We flew down a chute of grey water, and our bows swung giddily. I thought that we were already out of control and waited for the crunch of rock and for the deck to burst open beneath my feet. Then I saw the bows steady, and the Blue Cross painted on the wall of rock was dead ahead. "Hard to starboard as we come up to the flag," my voice squeaked. But I picked out the man on the center island flagging us into the turn. And Kratas put the steering oar over and yelled at the benches. "All back right, pull together left." The deck canted sharply as we spun into the turn. The wall of rock flashed past us, and we were going at the speed of a galloping horse. One more turn and the first rapids lay ahead. Black rock stood across our path, and the waters piled upon it. The water took on the shape of the rocks beneath it. It bulged and stood in tall, static waves. It opened into smooth green gullies. It curled upon itself and exploded into veils of white, through which the rock snarled at us with black fangs. My stomach clenched as we leapt over the edge and dropped down the slope. At the bottom we wallowed and spun like a stalk of dry grass in a whirlwind. "Pull left!" Crutus bellowed. "Pull till your balls bounce!" We steadied and aimed for the next gap in the rock, and the white water dashed over the deck and into my eyes. It hissed alongside, running in tandem with us, and the waves stood taller than our poop deck. "By Seth's tattered and festering foreskin, I've not had so much sport since I tupped my first ewe," Crutus laughed, and the rock sprang at us like a charging bull elephant. We touched once, and the rock rasped along our belly. The deck shuddered beneath our feet, and I was too afraid to scream. Then Memnon's team pulled us free, and we raced on down. Behind us I heard the shattering crash as one of the other galleys struck hard. I dared not look round as I judged our next turn, but soon there was wreckage and heads of drowning men bobbing and swirling in the torrent on both sides of us. They screamed to us as they were borne away and dashed upon the spurs of rock, but we could offer them no succour. Death pressed hard upon our heels, and we ran on with the stench of it in our nostrils. In that hour I lived 100 lives and died in every one of them. But at last we were hurled from the bottom of the cataract into the main body of the river. Of the 23 galleys that had entered the gorge, 18 followed us out. The others had been smashed to flotsam, and the corpses of their drowned crew washed down beside us in the grey Nile flood. There was not time for us to celebrate our deliverance. Dead ahead lay the island of Elephantine, and on both banks of the river stood the well-remembered walls and buildings of the city. "Archers, string your bows," King Tomosa called from the bows. "Hoist the blue pennant. Drummer, increase the beat to attack speed." Our tiny squadron flew into the mass of shipping that clogged the roads of Elephantine. Most of it was made up of trade barges and transports. We passed these by and went for the Hyksos galleys. The Hyksos had manned their fighting ships with Egyptian sailors, for nobody knew the river better. Only their officers were Hyksos. Most of them were ashore, carousing in the pleasure palaces of the docks. Our spies had told us which was the flag of the southern admiral, a swallowtail of scarlet and gold so long that the end of it dipped in the water. We steered for the ship that flew her, and Memnon boarded her over the side with 20 men at his back. "Freedom from the Hyksos tyrant," they roared. "Stand up for this very Egypt." The crew gaped at them. They had been taken completely by surprise, and most of them were unarmed. Their weapons were locked away below decks, for the Hyksos officers trusted them not at all. The other galleys of our squadron had each picked out one of the enemy fighting ships and boarded it as swiftly. On all of them the reaction of the crew was the same. After the first surprise they shouted the question, "Who are you?" And the reply was, "Egyptian, the army of the true Pharaoh Tomosa. Join with us, countrymen. Cast out the tyrant." They turned on their Hyksos officers and cut them down before we could reach them. Then they embraced our men, roaring out a welcome. "For Egypt," they cheered. "For Tomosa. For Egypt and Tomosa." The cheering jumped from ship to ship. Men danced upon the rails and swarmed up the masts to tear down the Hyksos banners. They broke open the arms stores and passed out bows and swords. Then they poured ashore. They dragged the Hyksos from the taverns and hacked them to bloody shreds, so that the gutters discharged a scarlet flood into the harbour waters. They ran through the streets to the barracks of the garrison and fell upon the guard. "For Egypt and Tomosa," they chanted. Some of the Hyksos officers rallied their men and held out for a while in pockets surrounded by the rabble. Then Kratos and Memnon came ashore with their veterans, and within 2 hours the city was ours.